Oh, what a tangled web. The effort to take out President Trump reaches critical mass. We'll talk about it on The Uprising.
LibertyNation.com. They're the resistance, but we are The Uprising. With Scott Cosenza and Tim Donner.
There's not going to be a President Donald Trump.
Hey, a president! Can you believe it?
I love the poorly educated.
The voters have guaranteed themselves slavery, economic disaster.
I can't believe I'm losing to this guy.
You could put half of Trump's supporters into what I call the basket of deplorables.
I have never met with Russians.
Our elected representatives can abuse subordinates and then secretly use a slush fund of our money to pay them off.
Black Lives Matter, the Antifa movement, is interested in preserving the fabric of America.
This is The Uprising, the podcast of LibertyNation.com. Tim Donner and Scott Cosenza coming at you double barrel this week.
The band is back together.
We are indeed, and the band plays on. So, Scott, special counsel Robert Mueller may be getting ready to subpoena the president.
Mm-hmm.
The heat gets turned up on Trump lawyer and fixer Michael Cohen. A Russian company indicted by Mueller calls his bluff.
Yes.
Three judges admonish the special counsel for overreach. The New York Attorney General quits.
It's quite a list here.
After revelations. I mean, I got to put it all out there. The New York Attorney General quits after revelations that he's a phony feminist who sexually assaulted multiple women. And we're talking about assaulted, not just harassed. And as we said, Scott, the band plays on. So let's start with the latest. You wrote a piece on LibertyNation.com about some payments that were made by Novartis, the pharmacy lawyer and fixer for President Trump. Just for background, a criminal referral was made by the special counsel to the Southern District of New York, which is now pursuing it. So tell us about these payments that have now been revealed as having been made to Michael Cohen, and include in this whether there's clear violations of privacy.
This is a compound question, counselor. Let's take off some bite-sized chunks of it.
Well,
okay?
it reminds me of it was a press conference one time where they said, because of the number of reporters here, we're going to limit everybody to one question. And the first guy gets up, says, I have one question, but it has 19 parts.
Right.
Anyway, take us through latest on Michael Cohen.
So, by the way, when I wrote the piece, Novartis is what I had in mind. I didn't realize that it was the French pronunciation, so I appreciate Novartis. There you go.
Novartis.
Right.
Yeah, right.
Michael Avenatti, Stormy Daniels' lawyer, published a document that identified all these payments that he said were made to a company controlled by Michael Cohen that he set up on the eve of the election and consequently on the eve of the $130,000 payment to Stormy Daniels commensurate with her signature and agreeing to the confidentiality agreement, okay? The quote-unquote hush money, as Mr. Avenatti likes to say.
Right.
Now, presumably, he has those bank account details because he has the file from Mr. Davidson, the attorney who represented Ms. Daniels in that negotiation. But he released all these other details about payments to that bank account. Now, we don't know, sort of a very fascinating aside, Mr. Avenatti, of course, is not a prosecutor or banking regulator. Where he got this information, he didn't specify. But he produced this list of monies that were paid to Michael Cohen through this entity, this Delaware corporation. And a couple of the payments turned out to be likely to be not that Mr. Cohen, but some of the payments were actually underreported in the Avenatti document, and the companies actually came out, notably AT&T and Novartis, who came out and said, well, not only did we pay, but actually we paid even more than Avenatti had suggested. And the Novartis payment was, I believe, in excess of $1 million and hundreds of thousands of dollars for the AT&T payment. And Mr. Cohen is not known for his acumen in the pharmaceutical industry or pharmaceutical regulations.
Scott, he's got many talents of which you are not aware.
Certainly, I'm sure that's true. And I don't believe he's able to divine Wi-Fi signals or mobile data transfers. I don't know why. So the idea is AT&T, so these companies who have a lot of business before the federal government and would want to get close to somebody in power, especially the president of the United States, are paying this guy a ton of dough. They came out and said that they did pay the money, and in fact that they have been approached and interviewed by Robert Mueller, a special counsel's office, and cooperated fully with that investigation. So that's, I don't know that that's bad legal news for Mr. Cohen. Perhaps there's a violation there of some registered lobbyist issue. You know, there's all sorts of regulations. You take money to lobby somebody. But we don't know that there was anything more nefarious than just influence peddling. And I
But there's a Russian element to this story. Yes.
I'll add that, yeah. So another of the payments alleged was a about $500 million, maybe just a little shy of that, from Yevgeny blah blah blah, some right. Russian billionaire oligarch aluminum miner guy.
Right.
And Mr. Avenatti supposes that that payment was used to reimburse the $130,000 for Stormy Daniels. Now,
and does he have any proof of that other than that a payment was made and it was more than $130,000? Well, so therefore, it must have been used ipso facto. It must have been fact that it must have been used to reimburse.
There is, as I understand it, there is no indication that there was a reimbursement made. There's just his assertion that a payment was made. Now, given the truth of the payments from Novartis and AT&T, that does lend credence to his other allegations, right? He may have some inside acts. I mean, clearly he's got something going on, whether it's from the independent counsel's office itself. Now, since we know that AT&T and Novartis have said that they've cooperated, presumably there are at least several people in each of those organizations that know about that investigation. Maybe they dropped a dime. Donald Trump has many fans and many enemies. And so, you know, if you're in the general counsel's office in AT&T and you want to sink the president, maybe you drop the dime to Avenatti. So we don't know exactly where he's getting his information from, but at least substantially some of it's proven to be right. And I think that, Tim, you know, before I get into some more of that, if this were a Democrat president and their personal lawyer was taking millions of dollars in a way that seemed pretty shady and inappropriate, we would be railing on them. And I think it's appropriate to rail on Mr. Cohen for this. Why is he getting paid $1 million from a pharmaceutical company?
What do we know about Cohen's other involvements, his other professional engagements? Because it seems to appear, and the media is projecting this, that, you know, he has one client, that's Donald Trump, and nobody else. All of his work is on behalf of Donald Trump. Is that an accurate statement?
You know, attorneys don't like file public records for their client list. So you could hire me today to advise you on some legal matter, and nobody would know about it except for the two of us, right? So we don't know. But Cohen, I think, and I can't point to a quote or anything, but I think he has talked about having a small client set. We actually know from some financial records that he is heavily involved in the New York taxi medallion business. He owns a number of medallions, which, by the way, not
that is
in
a
the
gold mine.
Well,
gold
it used
mine.
To be before Uber and Lyft.
Yeah, well, that's true.
I think that there's been a massive decrease in, I mean, they were up to over a million at one point, and I think now they're just a couple hundred thousand. So for people who don't know, in order to operate a taxi cab in New York City, you have to have what's called a medallion. It's actually like a physical, almost like a badge.
Right.
They bolt right onto the top of the car, and it allows you to pick up fares. And there's a limited number of those, and so the city keeps them artificially low so that the people who own them can benefit more from them. And there you go. That drives the value. But Lyft and Uber suppress, you know, the value of those. So he's involved in that. He's also involved in real estate. Donald Trump has talked about his own real estate investing. He owns a multi-million-dollar property in one of the Trump towers that apparently he bought, you know, as an investment. So he's got, you know, his hands in a few things, it seems to be. No previous history that we've ever seen reported or talked about with, again, pharmaceutical regulation or AT&T's, you know, business. So that all seems fishy.
All right. So let's try to put this into a larger context. It seems that Mueller might be trying to, in a sense, federalize this investigation by making criminal referrals to federal courts in various states, including, of course, New York, where there's a particular anti-Trump climate. And that means Mueller can hand off the dirty linen, so to speak, to someone else and wash his hands of it. So here's my point, Scott. It seems that even if the special counsel investigation ends next week, next month, in a few months, the Michael Cohen case could go on and on and continue to put the heat on Trump.
This is part of the sprawl of this is why so many people don't want a special counsel investigation. Right. Once you start that ball rolling, you never know. It could be like a tree. It grows all different branches all over the place, Tim. And
I think the Bill Clinton people would agree that when these special counsel investigations, whether they're of Democrats or Republicans, they go off the rails, they expand exponentially, like from Whitewater into Monica Lewinsky, and the federal prosecutor is demonized either by the left if he's going after a Democrat, or by the right if he's going after a Republican. Mm-hmm. And the whole special, I mean, it seems to me to be so wholly unconstitutional to give that much authority, almost unfettered authority, exponential, infinite authority to a special prosecutor who's an unelected and unappointed bureaucrat.
Tim, he did it to himself, though. He did it to himself.
By firing Comey?
Well, and Sessions and Rosenstein, meaning Donald Trump has the power to fire Robert Mueller right this second.
Right.
Now, I realize that's probably politically untenable. Right.
Well,
okay?
Now you understand.
But legally, that's...
But now you understand why Trump is so angry and has been at Jeff Sessions, because Sessions neglected to mention before he appointed him attorney general, oh, by the way, Mr. President, I'm going to be recusing myself of this Russia thing. Jeff Sessions, I have to say, has been a major disappointment. He seems to me to be the Peter principle, that he's reached his level of incompetence. Well, seriously, Scott, I mean, the guy appears to be feckless. It appears as if he has no power or no control over the Department of Justice. Or am I overreacting?
Well, he's clearly staked out a position that the detente on marijuana laws needs to be addressed. Tim,
he was spoken to on that one, I think. Because there's another example, Scott. I mean, I've said all along and contended that, you know, Trump is pretty much a libertarian when it comes to this issue. You know, live and let live, let the states decide. And yet Sessions, I think, went off the reservation and decided because of his personal animus against people that use any form of drug that he would ramp up the fight on marijuana just as the country is ramping it down. And that's the only notable thing, really, that he's done, other than maybe the
settlement on the
IRS targeting of conservatives. But, you know, that's the point that I'm trying to make, is that if people think that the special counsel investigation ending will be the end of this, this Michael Cohen thing could go on and on and on.
If it keeps on raining, the levee is going to break. And I wouldn't want to be in Mr. Cohen's shoes right now.
Okay, now, based on the notion that most investigations work their way up from the bottom to the top, you go to the underlings first and you save the big fish for last. That's how it went with Hillary Clinton, for example.
That's a typical federal way to, when you flip, you just keep flipping up the chain.
Right. So would you surmise then that this investigation is nearing its final stage, or is that just trying to blindly read the tea leaves? I mean, they have
it's
the
hard to imagine
the questions
with, the,
have
with
been,
the time that's been spent that they can't be too far from the end, right? I mean,
well, but 1 year is nothing for a special counsel, Scott.
Yeah. The answer to your question is probably the latter is true. It's probably guesswork, and we don't know. You know, we can all take a stab at what's actually going on there, but it's difficult to say. It's hard to imagine, though, how. Yeah. It's one of those things, Tim, where, you know, you can attribute so much to what's going on behind the black box, right? That you can get to a point where you're inventing things that aren't actually occurring, and I want to resist that temptation. But it seems like, what are they doing?
Well, right. if they in fact have formulated questions for Trump and they've sent that to Trump's legal team, knowing that it would leak somehow, that
let's talk about that for a second.
Right, they're putting their target on Trump, which leads one to believe that they've reached the top of the food chain, and therefore at least the final stage, whether that be weeks, months, or whatever, has begun. That would be the
let's talk about that subpoena issue if we might for a minute, because I think that's actually an educational point that we can make. So Mueller, the idea is Mueller wants to subpoena Donald Trump to appear before a grand jury. Now, a grand jury, if you go and sit before a grand jury, you don't have your attorney in the room with you, okay? You just go in and it's the prosecutor and the venire or the members of that grand jury. They are notoriously easily led. They're not of an independent and robust mind. There aren't lawyers, you know, usually seated on that grand jury, right? It's the postman and the candlestick maker and whatever who's in there.
And it's a low bar, right, for bringing an indictment. Yes. I mean, in other words, because
Saul Wachler, I think, is the name of the famous New York state judge who said that any prosecutor worth his salt could indict a ham sandwich.
Right.
Now, he later said that he was misquoted. It was probably a pastrami sandwich, by the way. I want you to know that.
That's good. That's really good.
But the idea is that it's exceedingly easy to indict somebody. And the reason why it's exceedingly easy is because it's not, like so much of our justice system, an adversarial process. There's nobody there making an argument that this behavior or activity is not criminal. It's just one-sided.
Right.
And if you can't win a one-sided argument, then you are really horrible. And I'm sure that all of Mueller and his people can win that one-sided argument. So the idea is that if you get Trump into that room, and this week it also came out that, and who knows if it's true, it's not like it came out officially. There's it's all leak, right?
Right.
So we're presuming that these leaks are true for the most part. But that Mueller refused an offer to submit questions in writing that the president would then respond to in writing. And, of course, the idea is that our president has a problem with shooting his mouth off extemporaneously. And if they could contain the questions to writing, then he could make appropriate responses that would not incriminate himself and be accurate and dot I's and cross T's. So Mueller wants him in that room. And any prosecutor would want him in that room because that's where the power balance shifts entirely to the prosecutor. I encourage everyone who's interested to read the relevant segment of Will, the book by G. Gordon Liddy. And Liddy talks about how to frustrate a grand jury proceeding if you don't want to participate in it, but you feel like you're legally compelled to. And in fact, if anybody out there has the president's ear, I encourage them to get that section to Donald Trump. And basically, there are things that you can do. You can actually leave the jury room at any time to confer with your attorney. So while you can't have them in the room and they can't present arguments to the jury, you can ask your attorney questions. And so Liddy would say, you know, please state your name for the record. And he would say, okay, let me go. I'd like to confer with my attorney. And he would go out for like 20 minutes and talk to his lawyer about, you know, the Yankees game or whatever, right? And then come back in and he'd say, G. Gordon Liddy. And then they'd say, okay, and where are you employed? And he'd say, I'd like to go confer with my attorney. And basically, you know, a total attempt to sort of frustrate the system. So that's something that Trump could do. The other thing that he could do is just not comply with the subpoena, which is to say that he's an executive branch. He's the head of the executive branch, Article 2, and that Article 3, where the courts are, do not have the power to compel him or his behavior. So that's another way he could go. Alan Dershowitz, I talked about this on an LNTV segment this week, and I've been closely he's been closely following and writing a lot about this topic.
He's been excellent. We've done a lot on the radio show on Liberty Nation Radio about that, and he's pretty much convinced that there's a subpoena on the way.
Oh, well, certainly. But and he actually has said that he thinks Trump should try to fight the subpoena in the courts, getting basically three bites at the apple, which is the district court level would be the first place that they would appeal the issuance of the subpoena and say either, A, that I'm not, I being Donald Trump, I don't have to sit because I'm the president, and B, I only have to sit for a limited purpose. And then if they lose at that level, then they can go to the intermediate appellate court level, and then they, if they lose again, they can go to the Supreme Court. So there's multiple chances for him to, you know, sort of not have to sit for that that grand jury proceeding.
All right, a few other questions before we let you go. This is, people forget, a counterintelligence investigation. It is not a criminal investigation, Robert Mueller's special counsel investigation. What's the practical difference between the two?
Well, we don't have the full disclosure of the memo that does grant Mueller his grant of authority, right? And in fact, you mentioned at the top of the podcast the rebuke by federal judges of Mueller. One of those instances happened in federal court in Alexandria, where this was the is this the Manafort? So there's so many things going on. Yeah, this I think was the this was Manafort asking the court to suppress the results of the search that the FBI conducted on his residence, saying that the grant of authority for Mueller did not relate back to a 2006 or 2007 banking issue, right? And that's what the FBI and the Justice Department is now prosecuting him for partially. And the judge there demanded a full and unredacted submission of the memo of the grant of authority to Mueller. Now that he'll take that in camera or confidentially, so we will not be able, at least that was due yesterday, I think. We will not be able to see that just now, but the judge will. So the judge himself, Tim, based on what's publicly available, doesn't know what Mueller's grant of authority is, what's legal for him to go after. But I will say this again, the reason why people fight so hard against the special counsels, once they're unleashed, they just go everywhere.
It's so predictable. So, we knew this would happen. I mean, everybody knew it. Everybody predicted it. The left celebrated it. The right tried to resist it. But let me ask you this, though, because
we didn't know how bad Comey was, though. So horrible. I mean, just an awful human being.
But lest we forget, up until about 2 years ago, James Comey was considered a paragon of virtue.
Sterling.
And this is the same thing that we heard about Mueller.
Yeah.
Before he started. And now so much of what he's done has been diminished publicly in certain media, certainly not in the establishment.
And they're starting
media.
To go back, by the way, in his record and get into some of this Whitey Bulger material.
Yeah, that's
There's a trial ongoing right now in Boston. One of the many that have yielded from this. And for people who don't know, Whitey Bulger was the main gangster in Boston for decades, I think, and was a main source of the FBI. He basically turned in his competition and was allowed to get away with murder, literally, until finally he wasn't. And then he was on the run and But
men who Mueller knew to be innocent were allowed to remain
to linger in prison
so that he wouldn't burn a confidential source.
And that's what we know so far. So it'd be interesting to see. If we know that that's the one, you know, that's easily discoverable, relatively speaking. What else about his past do we not know? Does he have the same propensity to leak confidential information to politically damage his, you know, his perceived enemies, like we know that Comey did. You know, Comey. The more we learn about Comey,
it's not good.
Yeah, it's really bad.
Okay, let's pursue one more line here in this tangled web, which is the name of this edition of the Uprising,
the Stormy Web,
and that is that. It was, I don't remember exactly, it was about 2 months ago or so, the special counsel, it was actually Rod Rosenstein who went out there and announced the indictment of 13 Russian companies for interference in the election. And he figured that's a free shot at the,
Let me explain if I might.
Hang on 1 sec, though, because I just want to say it's a one-way indictment in a sense that the indictment it seemed to me, was being made knowing that none of these companies were actually going to fight it. So he could bear down on them and he could talk them down and talk about how they interfered in the election, and none of them would challenge it. They would,
yes,
they would,
because they're Russian companies, they don't have to appear right in U.S. courts.
But now one of them has said, okay, I'll call your bluff. Right. So will we learn from the discovery that's required to adjudicate that case against the Russian company that that evidently shocked Mueller by taking up the indictment? What might we learn from the discovery phase of that trial?
I think that we're probably going to learn nothing, because I think that they're going to drop the indictment against the company who has posted up. So just so for people who don't understand, Tim, if you're operating a company in Russia, for instance, and you're indicted by an American court, it would just be the same way as if you're in America and you're indicted by a Russian court. If you don't have property or bank accounts or businesses in Russia, what do you care? You're just, you know, go pound sand, right?
Right.
And so that's why they figured they were going to not have to produce a case beyond the press conference, because they figured nobody would show up in court to fight this thing.
Right.
And one company, and this is interesting because unlike a person who has to show up in court in person, right, to answer their charges, the company just hired a law firm and had their lawyers show up and said, okay, we're here. We're here to defend ourselves. And they said, they actually said that.
This is amazing.
They used it's funny. I was going to write this line and I didn't know how to write it sort of in a quick couple sentences to get the impression of what I was talking about. But we all know the movie scenes where the guy's like hiding in a closet where the process server's on the door, like, Mr. Smith, I have your subpoena here. Right. Or a guy dressing up like a gardener to serve suit papers, you know?
Yeah.
Well, that's service of process.
Right.
It's one of the most foundational and important parts of our justice system is that you have to be served notice that you actually are charged, whether that's a civil or criminal case. And it's not necessarily easy to serve a Russian individual who's friends with Putin, you know, in Russia, right? So many defendants actually use the service of process argument to try to get out of having to defend themselves in a lawsuit. They say, we were not properly served. This is the exact opposite. The company has said, oh, we understand we're a party to this indictment. Right. We're here to defend ourselves. And Mueller's team has said, wait a second, we don't have proper service here. And they're like, just reach across the courtroom aisle, literally, and hand them a copy of the indictment. There's your service, right? They're not contesting service. They're demanding that the proceedings actually take place. And because, again, like we said, they didn't actually think they'd ever have to make that case beyond a press conference, they now don't want to do it.
So, well, wait a second, though. Because if they just simply drop the indictment, it means that it just unmasks Mueller as doing nothing but grandstanding.
It's pretty embarrassing, Tim. That's right. Yes.
But you really think they're going to drop it? I mean, seriously? That they don't have the information
So that'll be a good test, right?
Yeah,
they have damning and good information that there was some sort of nefarious collusion or whatever, then they'll have to produce it in discovery. So just for people who don't know, it's incumbent upon the prosecution to present all their evidence to the defense prior to a trial so that the defense can then investigate and challenge that evidence for themselves. That's part of the discovery process. That's what they're asking for, and that's the problem for Mueller if there isn't, in fact, that evidence there. Now, even if there is that evidence there, it does present a challenge to the prosecution, which is that you don't want to reveal, you know, if he's going after the president, for instance, as a more juicy target, you don't want to, sort of show your cards, right, to this lower level thing. So that presents a problem There are multiple problems here. Now, I wouldn't be surprised to see that indictment just dropped.
Right, but that would be a real public black eye for Robert Mueller.
Does he care?
Well, he may not care, but it lends further credence to whatever his announcement is at the end of the process having any real credibility when he's doing a publicity stunt by indicting 13 companies. It's like taking a free punch at a guy's face when his hands are tied behind his back. You can just punch as long as you want. And now they're prepared to punch back.
Yeah, and here's another thing, too. If you actually wanted to prosecute a Russian, okay, you wouldn't publicly announce the indictment. You wouldn't say anything about it. You'd quietly try to place a notice in a file where if he traveled to a place that would extradite him or to the United States, he would be picked up. But you don't hold a press conference, say, I want this this guy.
Right.
What's he going to do? You think he's going to come to the United States now? Right. So that again argues for that the only reason for that announcement was to sort of shame and embarrass. And again, feed the fire, feed the narrative that Russia somehow produced President Trump.
Well, the reason that, and we'll, for the purposes of this, we'll call it special prosecutor, even though his title is officially special counsel.
Sure.
Special prosecutors are charged to prosecute, not to let people off the hook. And he figured he had 13 heads, that if he got nothing else, at least he could say that he got 13 Russian companies, you know, and the digital farms in Eastern Europe and all this stuff. And and now,
with their $20,000 worth of Facebook ads or whatever, whatever it was,
many of which, by the way, were after the election, which proves that their whole intent, in whatever degree of interference there was to simply sow confusion and to sow discord among the electorate. And you got to give Putin or the Russians credit, because they certainly have done that. Okay,
agreed.
Thank you, Scott.
Thanks, Tim.
Don't forget to use Liberty Nation's new audio feature so that you don't miss your dose of truth and facts, no matter how busy you may be. Now you can get narrated versions of all our top stories by simply clicking on the Play SoundCloud or Play in Browser tab in the Listen to the News section of our website. At LibertyNation.com, the truth is always just two clicks away. I'm Tim Donner, and this is The Uprising, the podcast of LibertyNation.com.